fake it, and there's a lot of people out there willing to fake it for ad cents alone. And, you know, I mean, unfortunately, you know, back in the really bad days of AI, AI was giving out mixes, recipes, in which they included poison as the ingredient. So, again, let the buyer beware. I can't tell you for sure whether these things are legit or not, and I don't have the time or the inclination to be a detective, but I'm sure a lot of them are BS, because a lot of things in life tend to be BS, unfortunately.
Thank you very much, Roy. Yes, I noticed, and you corrected me quite a few times, my thinking about YouTube and information from YouTube. I remember one of the scientists that you pointed at as a sort of troll in humoristic form of meaning of it. But then when you just mentioned about the credentials, well, I'm recalling Dr. Judy Wood. It didn't help her to get involved into the subject of 9/11. Although she had a lot of merit, especially me having the office at 77th floor of World Trade Center. Back to you, N2HGN.
AP2GS. By the way, Les, have you seen any YouTubes from a guy who calls himself Professor Zhao?
I believe I know who you're talking about. There is a Chinese guy who just recently got popularity, extreme popularity, and my wife pointed to me at this guy who is somewhere in China in high school teaching students and doesn't even have a master degree. Am I talking about the same guy?
Yeah, he has a bachelor's, supposedly. He has a bachelor's in English literature, but he calls himself professor. And he was a high school teacher. And he says he specializes in game theory. I was taught game theory. The stuff that he shows is not game theory. The stuff he shows is storytelling. But he says, you know, he has lectures where he explains how science is all wrong, the Big Bang never happened, evolution didn't occur, or at least doesn't occur for human beings. It might occur for everything below the level of human being, but in human beings, it, evolution doesn't work, he says. And basically, he's, I don't know, I assume he's got some kind of scam going. And I'm curious, because the Chinese government has to approve of this. He lives and he works in China. They don't even allow people to watch YouTube there. So in order for him to get away with presenting things on YouTube, he has to have party approval. So I'm not quite sure exactly what he's propagandizing. Occasionally, it's obviously the Chinese government. But in a weird way, he seems to believe in creation theory. He kind of seems to believe in a higher power telling him what to give lectures on. So I don't know if he's just a grifter or he's a lunatic.
Interesting. My understanding is he's not a lunatic. He's a propaganda tool. You're absolutely right. Absolutely 100% right. So, when I was talking to my wife about him, she said, listen, it's a Chinese trick. I'm trying to be gentle with words. Okay. Anyhow, talking about Dr. Judy Wood and 9/11. what she is, real scientist, American scientist, with proper credentials. But unfortunately, it wasn't good for her career to get involved into that. Back to you, and I have one more topic to discuss. And bless you.
Well, you know, I mean, it's not unusual for people with good credentials to fall over the emotional cliff. They'll go a little wacky. Again, I'll bring up Linus Pauling, who got into this obsession about vitamin C is the cure of everything. The guy's a Nobel Prize winner. But that doesn't mean that you're vulnerable to nervous breakdowns and such. You know, so it doesn't surprise me. A lot of people kind of get past their skis, and it usually doesn't lead to a continued career. There's a kind of feedback mechanism in the scientific community. If you start to act irrational and make comments that make no sense, the rest of the professionals kind of isolate you and kick you out of the club. You know, there was a guy who did excellent research in HIV back at the very beginning in France, and then he fell off a cliff and started to say that HIV virus doesn't give you the autoimmune disorder. It's completely a different thing, and he just sputtered to an end. So, again, you know, sometimes we just kind of lose ourselves.
I understand what you're talking about, and I do agree with your point of view. The only difference is that Dr. Judy Wood wasn't caught on inconsistency. She was precise and concise in what she claimed. The only problem was that Dr. Judy Wood was not in line with official opinion in this area. We're talking about 9/11. And that's why she even had her website, and then the picture starts to disappear. And I noticed at the time quite a few scientists who were taking the side of Dr. Judy Wood. But anyhow, it's a past. We all have our opinion about it. I'm not trying to get into the conspiracy theory, but I believe she had a lot of merits in her claim. The next subject is beamforming, but acoustic, for drone detection and elimination. So, let me jump. Okay. So, I sent you an email, beamforming but acoustic for drones detection and elimination. And we know about beamforming in access points that we install or we have installed, and that's electronic form of the beamforming. But here we have a mechanical one. And if you look at the video that I have sent you, it's 16 seconds and 1 minute 24 seconds. I'm not sure you had a choice to look at those. It's amazing. And I recall, I believe it was Boston, they were trying to install, that was 20 years ago, a system that would react on the gunshot from the pistol, and it would show exact position of this gunshot. But here they use it for a very specific frequency of the the drones. Usually those are the drones, Russian drones. They use very cheap Chinese engines, and those devices were able to create some sort of array to capture the unique noise signature of the drone propellers and rotors. And those systems use beamforming techniques to estimate the direction of arrival of sound, enabling initial detections and eventually take countermeasures. So I wonder if you had a chance to look into it.
I think I saw a minute or two of it. The underlying concept makes sense. Again, just how small can you pack it into a detector, how much weight it has, how much power it requires, and all manner of other things. They are tweaking and modifying drone design every day, both in Russia, I'm sure, and certainly in Ukraine. And it'll continue. Apparently Ukrainians shipped a bunch of their drones down to the Middle East, and with I think something like 200 technicians, and they're going to see what they can do to get rid of Iran's drone attacks and such. But it's an ongoing exercise. Everyone kind of jumps past the other, and the drones that will be available commercially in 2 years are going to be dramatically different than the stuff that's available today. You have fiber optics, and they've extended the range in Ukraine. There's a kill zone where the Ukrainians just kind of sit back kilometers behind the war and drop grenades and other explosives on Russians just kind of wandering in the kill zone. So it's going to keep on getting more technical and more sophisticated. So you're going to be reading articles somewhat similar to that for the next few years until something happens and this war ends.
To information, passive operation, detection of autonomous drones, 24/7 functionality, I'm reading right now, and 99.2% recognition rate versus the background noise. So we are in environment of New York or the big city of Kiev in Ukraine, right? And we need to recognize incoming Iranian, because Iran first sold his drones to Russia, and then Russia started to manufacture those drones, but anyhow. And the interesting for me is that even though that they have a 10.7 meters radial error, the closer you are, the smaller is that error, because it's inverse square law that is applied to it. So then you can theoretically hit in one by one inch of an object if you're close enough. So in other words, there is almost no way for that technology to be in error unless there are two or three or four of them, and then there is not enough of drones, counter drones, to take over. Back to Jan Tracy.
You also have to factor in that it may be that the closer you are, the more accurate you are, but the closer you are, the shorter time interval you have available to effectively accomplish anything. You know, I mean, if it's a 16th of an inch away from you, yeah, you know exactly where it is. But, you know, if it's going to blow up on you, then it doesn't really, you know, rather than you blow up on it. So, you know, there are more complicating aspects to it. It's not just accuracy at decreasing distances, but, you know, how much you can maneuver a piece of equipment when there's next to no distance between you. But, again, I'm always for technology. Is it the end of are they going to sit on their prestige? No, they'll move on. You know, they'll come up with something else. They'll have drones that just kind of send noise bursts and disrupt the device. And there'll be countermeasures and measures and countermeasures and measures. That's the nature of war.
Okay, thank you. So the end of the story is Ukrainians, they propose to our president help with a problem of Iranian drones. And as far as I know, he refused that, but all of the countries involved in that war or in that conflict, whichever wording we use for it, they decided to use the Ukrainian help, so they sent about 250 professionals with the technology and those drones that are anti-Iranian drones, specially made for those exact drones, because Russia uses the same drones. Okay. And the last one. A quarter, which is one-third of the helium needed for semiconductors, is no longer delivered because of the problem that we have with Iran. Okay, and that's the last one. So I'm going to read it. The Iran crisis is disrupting the global helium supply because Qatar, which produces about one-third of the world's helium, has halted output due to Iranian drone strikes and the closure of Strait of Hormuz. I wonder if you ever had a chance to follow how helium is manufactured and to exist.
I wouldn't really say it's manufactured. It's refined, but it's not really manufactured. There are uranium deposits all under the crust, and they undergo alpha decay. Alpha particles are basically helium nuclei. They pick up some electrons, and they're helium gas. And they're situated in gas and oil deposits close to uranium deposits. And they're cryogenically processed to separate the helium from the natural gas.
All right. And then, yes, I used proper wording for it. The Ras Laffan Industrial City is in Qatar, a place where that separation is being done. But I wonder what they do with that fossil gas where... Oh, I believe the gas goes to this different place and then changed to a GS2 and LNG. And so... But helium is separated through cryogenic distillation. So it is already... LNG. I mean, you don't like to explain to me that.
Okay. All these oil wells have a mixture of crude oil. Crude oil is made out of just about every type of carbon chain. Things from methane, where it's a single carbon chain, to paraffins and waxes and such. So in the case of liquid natural gas, it's mostly, I think, in a gas form. It depends upon the pressure in the cavities and such. But as soon as you vent them, they tend to vaporize, and you have to put them in some kind of cold storage and pressurize them and have them turn into the liquid phase, because they take up a lot less volume. I mean, you need to keep them at a low temperature. You need to keep them at a high pressure. But that's the usual method that people transport natural gas in the liquid form.
Echo 2, Yankee Gum.
So, I have quite a few devices that use helium. One of them is it allows me to find out the periodicity components in any sample that is put inside. So that's and then I have a few electromicroscopes. And then I have liquid nitrogen form. And for that, I need helium because it operates basically. And then I have a chamber that I told you, the chamber that gives me 4 degrees Kelvin or even less than that. It goes to 2 degrees Kelvin. 2 degrees Kelvin. Yeah, so I wonder how much am I going to be paying right now for helium, the helium hydrogen.
Well, it depends. I'm sure there's some storage facilities where, companies and industries probably store up certain amounts of helium. It's been going up in price, as far as I'm aware, forever. There's more and more uses for it, and, there's only limited supplies. So, I don't know. I think everything's going to go up, and so why should helium be any different?
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I'm going to be helium next time. I'm going to see how much I have to pay. I have to pay for the gasoline. Thank you very much, Mr. Roy, for today. I have nothing more. And back to you, I think.
Okay, very good, Wes. Thank you for your participation. I appreciate it. Sam, I heard you a little bit earlier on. I just figured I'd let Wes kind of roll it all up. What can I do you for tonight, Sam?
Well, it's interesting. This is Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf, and I know LIMAR stands for Long Island Mobile, and I'm really interested in seeing if a mobile rig in the car. So I was looking to the club to see if they had some words of wisdom about how to set up a rig in the car, and based on their experience, what are they using, and are they working with the antennas, and how they work with VHF as well as HF. So it's kind of a wide open area, but I'm sort of interested in seeing what's the best way to handle it without causing too much damage to a new car. So, Roy, that's basically my question or what I'd like to discuss this evening. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Well, you probably get more comments about UHF and VHF because probably more than 9 out of 10 radios that people use in their cars are UHF, VHF. For more local conversations, it has easier mechanical aspects of antennas, since antennas scale depending upon the wavelength that you're operating on. It allows you to operate with a smaller antenna with less compromises and more efficiency. I'll open it to the audience because I'm sure there's a lot of mobile operators. There's a lot of mobile radios. They're pretty much all designed with 12-volt power. You plug it into your battery in your car. It's up to you whether you want a professional installation where they fit it in where the old radio went, or some people prefer it to kind of just hang out in the seat next to them, and they disconnect it and they put it in the back of their the hood of their the trunk of their car, and so that no one will break into their car and steal it from them. So there's a lot of variation, especially with VHF and UHF. If anyone out there would like to offer their opinion to Sam, who's looking into the idea of becoming a mobile operator, hit that push to talk and say hello.
KC2SHO.
Yes, John.
May have had the volume a little low when the question was asked. Is he talking about any band, or is he looking to get into HF? Sorry, I missed a bit of that.
Okay, he kept it kind of open-ended. He said UHF, VHF, and certainly the higher frequencies of HF. I think I talked to him earlier, and he was mentioned 10 meters, but also UHF and VHF. So, it's, yeah, anyone with any advice, you know, it's kind of a wide open question.
Yeah, I guess my response would be whatever the budget, or I shouldn't say whatever the budget can afford. It might be dependent on what the budget is. You know, like you said, lots of lots of really nice VHF and UHF radios out there. You could also do the shack-in-the-box solution where you have one radio that does it all. I know they're older now, but I've got these 857s, these FT-857s all over the place, and in the car with the ATAS-120A antenna, you know, I can work 20 through 6 meters. So, or sorry, a 40 through 6 meters. I have to do a little extra grounding. My 40 is a little bit wonky. I think the tailgate might be needing some grounding, maybe down through the frame too. But anyway, you know, lots of fun. One radio that does lots of stuff, and of course, sideband VHF and UHF as well. There's lots of modern equivalents to that radio too. Hope that helps. KC2SHO.
Yes,
you.
It does, John.
That's a thought. After listening to Roy for a couple of moments, it sounds like VHF, you know, in the 2 meter repeaters might be where the easiest action would be for me to use. There was a particular rig that someone suggested called the KT9900 mobile rig. I don't know if anyone's heard of it or uses it or has something similar, but maybe going with a VHF 2 meter repeater might be a very fun way for me to get into it. Any thoughts? Thank you.
Okay, very good, Sam. I mean, one of the important provisos that you mentioned is you want to do as little to no damage to your shiny new car as you possibly can. That kind of introduces a series of problems because, you know, there's things that cause less damage, but I don't know of anything that's guaranteed to cause no damage. Obviously, I doubt that you want to punch holes in your chassis, so an NMO-mounted antenna for VHF and UHF is a no-no. You have choices under those circumstances of either a magnetic mount, which you don't have to punch any holes, but people have been known to scratch the finish of their cars, all the way to special case glass magnetic coupled, capacitively coupled via magnets. And you put the magnets on both sides of the window. That probably won't cause any permanent damage either, but you know it's not as robust as a regular mag mount on the body of your car. Anyone with any good ideas of how to keep the installation to a minimum as far as damaging a car?
AD2DU.
Yeah, what do you got for us?
So, I didn't want to go through the firewall on my Subaru Outback. So, I have a cup holder mount to a VHF-UHF radio that just pops out of the cup holder. And then behind the passenger seat, I have a 100 amp hour battery. I just pull the battery out of the air and charge it and then bring it back to the car. It's totally removable and it's totally hidden if you park in New York City. I can collapse the cup holder mount and that radio just hides in the center console. You can also do portable HF. But most people do that outside their car because it necessitates a larger antenna. For an antenna in my car, I use a 19-inch mag mount.
Do you get any scratching on the finish?
Not really. I take it down a lot. I know Signal Stick, the not-for-profit great handheld antennas make a car mag mount also, and they sell a little, I think it's silicone thing that goes around the base of their mag mount also, to minimize that paint scratching. So yeah, if you leave your mag mount on all winter and the grit gets under there and whatnot, it can scratch the paint, but a little silicone or something is potentially an option.
Oh, very good. That makes sense. So Sam, there are some good ideas, depending upon, how little you want to impact the installation on your car. You could have practically no evidence of a radio setup, or you could have some. It depends on your sense of aesthetics and your willingness to kind of put holes in a nice new car.
Thank you, Roy. Thank you both. I was curious, what rig was he using that he was just describing?
Alex, what rig are you using?
It is a Yaesu STM-500. I think there's a slightly updated model of that radio out now. I like it a lot. It has you can see the whole band as you're scanning through it with the type of bar chart band scan. So you can see what's out there. I listen to aviation when I'm driving. I have the local NYPD frequency before I moved out of Queens, so it does well, 50 watts, and I can talk, 50 miles at its furthest if somebody has a high up repeater.
Yeah, very good. I have a STM 400 that I'm staring at on my desk.
I would say if you separate mobile HF and VHF UHF, I would do the setup like mine in the car. I think that Yaesu FDM 500 is great. I know Kenwood's coming out with a new radio this year also, VHF, UHF. And most, like, I carry a separate mag mount for an HF antenna that I can just pull out and hook to the same battery in the back seat of the car. I don't want to leave anything fully connected to the car battery. I don't want to deal with it. I'm not good at fixing cars. AD2D.
Okay, very good. Sounds like an excellent setup. And, yeah, Yaesu's make good UHF, EHF radios. Like I said, I have an FDM 400 that hasn't given me any problems since I bought it new. So, more information for you, Sam.
Echo 2, Yankee Golf, all good. All appreciated, Roy. And thank you, Net, for some input. I made a few notes, and tomorrow I'll be, looking more into it. I mean, it's a little bit exciting because it'll be a new dimension to ham radio for me. Back to you, Roy, and thank you.
KC2SHO.
Yes, John?
Yeah, one final thought while you're still listening, and that's in my wife's car. It's a really tiny little radio, and I think they make them even smaller now. Some of these Chinese radios, they're itty-bitty little things. It's a Radiodity DB20G. It goes by two other brands and models, too. It is a... it is an Anytone, I think, at its heart, just rebranded. But that little radio, I just have plugged into the lighter. It fits, geez, right in a little spot where, you might put some change or something, and I do have it screwed up to the dash there, but it's a tiny little thing. You could almost carry it around in your pocket. It is a full, functional radio, just... little Chinese thing and a little mag mount. Well, I got a good sized mag mount in the roof, and to be honest, sometimes I really don't notice the difference between driving around with my 50 watt Kenwood and the 20 watt Chinese radio. Works great.
Which model was that, please?
Radiodity sells it as the DB20G, which does stand for GMRS, but you just do a function key hold down thing when you turn it on, and then you choose the ham bands instead. And so it is the same radio as a Anytone, I don't know, 779 or something like that. But if you look it up, you'll see a Radiodity DB20G. Check it out. It's a little tiny thing. And there's a bunch of other options out there. That one's a dual bander. They even make tri-banders. Again, real tiny things. Not the cleanest, not the most sensitive, but they do work. And again, lighter plug and mag mount. That's it. I've done nothing to my wife's car other than plug that thing into the lighter plug. And there's some nice tape called strapping tape. If you look up 3M strapping tape, the blue stuff comes in a lot of printers and things like that. It doesn't leave a residue. I've got it running up the door and kind of taped there to make sure it doesn't, fall out or get pinched.
Very good. Great ideas. You might also want to contemplate whether you're interested in any of these digital voice modes. You might consider Yaesu for a fusion including radio or D-Star. It comes in Icon, or some variation of Chinese UHF, VHF radios that include the DMR.
Hey, it's Bill.
Yes, John?
Hey, Roy, it's Jeff. I just wanted to pop in and
state. I'm enjoying the net tonight. I'm a little bit worried about some of the comments about some of the cheaper radios that might have some harmonics outside of band. That's always a worry. I just wanted to draw everyone's attention to that and make sure that they read up on the type and quality of radio that they purchase and install QSL.
Yeah. Good point. Caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. There are some very well-made Chinese radios, but you got to kind of hunt them down. It's very easy to get a skunk. So, that's an important thing to keep in mind. Most of my radios tend to be Japanese, but I do have an Anytone. I happen to like my Anytones. I have two of them. But I also have a Baofeng, which I don't really find to be high quality. But it's okay for a disposable radio.
Those magnetic antenna situations work?
Yes, they work. They people buy them all the time. I have some, and I don't even have a car anymore. But yeah, they work. They couple capacitively to the ground of the your car, metal on your car, and they work as good as electrically grounded antenna would be.
I love a good toy, don't you?
Certainly. I mean, I've said it before, I'll say it again. The difference between men and boys is the price of the toys.
My kids' toys.
No, I haven't. Well, what can I tell you? I've seen some adult toys, and it's kind of difficult to match them price for price. I remember taking the tour to Andy WA to CDL's mansion, and he had a Tektronix scope. I think retail for something like $8,000 or $10,000.
Well, I don't tend to disagree. I was just trying to make a funny, but there's lots of fun toys here. Anyway, of course, you're going to get a lower quality radio with some of these Chinese things. A $109 radio compared to that brand new Kenwood that I've have the holding fee down on, which we're guessing is going to be about $1,000 radio. I mean, again, if $100 gets you on air and that's all you can afford, well, got to do what you got to do. Maybe a used radio would be better in that case. But these new radios, very low energy consumption is the point I was trying to get to. KC2, I see Joe. I'll keep quiet now.
But to buy, beware. There's a place for Chinese radios, and if you have a lot of experience with the different brands, there are occasionally surprisingly decent quality radios that are made in China. Like I've said many times before, I mean, iPhones are manufactured in China. So it's a matter of the cost of these things and the expense and bother of quality assurance programs. If you have a tough bunch of cast masters watching everything you do on the assembly line, chances are it'll come out a little bit better. I've gotten stuff out of China where they reverse the lead. That's not good.
Roy, we asked the question of the right people, okay, and it's been very, very productive. And once again, I thank you for your time, as always, okay? Anyway, I'll be standing by, but thank you very much for a lot of input.
Okay. You're welcome, Sam. Thank you for your participation. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net. We're still open. We've got a good half hour if people want to take advantage of it. So it's up to you guys out there. This is not a monologue. This is not a comedy show. So it takes two at least, and sometimes three, four, or five. If anyone has any questions or topics for discussion or comments that they would like to make, as long as they're amateur radio related or science and technology, please hit that push to talk and introduce yourself.
WB2BX with some questions and comments.
Certainly, Frank.
Okay, first of all, yeah, I've never done HF mobile. I hear an awful lot of portables on now. People who, as somebody commented, like operating outside of their cars, doing parks on the air, summits on the air, etc. Even some portable antennas and 20-watt Yesu radios, ICOM 703s, etc. I recall when I was a kid in the 70s, some of the guys in the local club had a monster bumper mount HF antennas on their cars with bumper mounts. I guess it was similar to trailer hitches. I know that doesn't work too well on 2 meters, though some people do that also because it's too close to the ground, but seems to work reasonably well on HF. I don't know if anybody does HF mobile that way anymore. One guy in the local radio club who shall remain nameless and callless because he's still active drove through the King's Plaza parking lot with his bumper mount HF antenna on the car and took out a row of lights. I don't think he was too popular with security. But anyway, there's one problem with those. Are you still copying me okay?
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of weird kind of undersound. It sounds like a baby crying.
Okay, it's not at this location. You may be hearing the TV in the other room, but there was something else that I was hearing, TV or phone. Anyway, one more interesting question I had. I was wondering, I forget, one of the podcasts I listened to, or maybe it was Universe Today, or one of those talks about the upper end of the electromagnetic spectrum being gamma rays. I'm wondering, is there a practical end to upper limit to the electromagnetic spectrum? I would think, from what I remember of my high school pre-calculus, that the electromagnetic spectrum would sort of approach infinity as a limit in terms of frequency, and zero is a limit in terms of wavelength, and on the upper end, on the lower end, I would think as you approach HF, your wavelength approaches infinity as a limit, while your frequency approaches zero as a limit, because zero would be DC. That's about the limit of my calculus. Maybe you can either tell me I'm all wet, or that's approximately right, or it's much more complicated than that. So go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, unfortunately, it is more complicated than that. But you got to go way beyond calculus. You got to go basically into quantum mechanics and the limitations of space time. You could only. You know, they're at the low end of time, it's not purely analog. You can't split seconds forever down to zero. You get to a certain limitation where it's short enough that nothing in physical space-time can occupy less time and less distance. So, you know, there are limitations to how small length can be and how short time can be. So that's on that end, there's a limitation there. On the other end, there's a limitation on how much energy you can pack into a photon. It comes to a certain point where the energy density breaks up the structure of space and time. So you can't have an infinite frequency of electromagnetic waves. So it's limited on that end. So you can't go to infinity, and although you can kind of jump from some number to zero, zero is possible, but you can't make an infinitesimal small interval of a period of a frequency because you get stuck in quantum rules and such. So, you know, generally speaking, it's very high to very low. There's a decided problem when you go up in frequency, whereas you can get down to a very low frequency, very close to, not at DC. It's a discontinuity between the lowest alternating current electromagnetic frequency and DC, which is, you know, steady state.
All right, that's kind of interesting. So it doesn't really, so frequency really, so as you said, frequency can never be infinity. It doesn't really approach infinity as a limit either. There's some finite point where, because of quantum effect, the frequency can't go any higher. And I guess at the low end where the frequency can't go any lower. Interesting. And that's probably, without knowing the mathematics, I probably can't go any deeper than that. Anyway, I was curious about that. That is kind of interesting. Anyway, back to that. B2BX, though.
AC2GS. Yeah, that's the Planck length. If you remember what they taught you in physics, that there are limitations to how small, because apparently space-time is not smooth. It's granular. It's like little pixels. But you have to go very, very, very deep into it before the smoothness goes away. And I think they also sometimes call it quantum foam. But it's the nature that it's not really analog. It's actually packages of time, packages of length and such. So that's defined by the Planck constant.
Yeah, okay. I kind of have an idea what the Planck limit is. All right, so essentially there are like the finite limitations. Interesting. One other comment, and you're probably familiar with that. My Windows 11 computer essentially stopped working. It sort of worked. For all practical purposes, it stopped working. It ran out of memory on the operating system, the OS C drive. So after running Change Manager a couple of times, that would free up some space, and then it would just clog up and stop working again. One of my wife's cousin referred me to a local techie who owns a computer store. He picked up the machine and said, "No problem, I'll give it a hard drive transplant and clone your old drive so you don't lose any of your settings, and you'll be back up and running again." Anyway, he called me and said, "Can't clone your hard drive, you'll have to start from default again," which I can do. It's a nuisance, but I can do it. They use some custom settings because my eyesight is poor. And anyway, he said the problem apparently, and I think I've heard of this before with Dell machines, is there's some boot block that does not let you clone the drive. Is that something unique to Dell machines, or is that a Windows type issue? Have you heard of that? Go ahead.
I've heard of that in general. Thankfully, I haven't experienced it. Dell works in mysterious ways. I remember a long time ago, I was going to use surplus equipment and to put together my own computer. Not knowing that Dell's power supply was at that time a non-standard connector. So if you took a Dell chassis with a Dell power supply and plugged it into a non-Dell motherboard at the time, it didn't work. So it took me a little time to figure out that one. Yeah, another thing you might want to try as a Band-Aid is, why you ran out of capacity could be something that's fixable. Every so often I get a piece of software that likes to leave log files as big as, gigabytes big. And every so often I have to go into the directory and delete the log files. And then I get more than enough capacity. But, if you do that and you leave the program to run, it'll just clog it up again. So maybe there's some errand program that's being very informative for the software engineer and leaving gigabytes of log data for him to massage and figure out.
KB2 Agent 2.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you hand it over to me, HHU?
Yes.
Yeah, just one thing, I was just listening here, with the non-cloning of the drive, one thing you might want to look into, maybe, is if the machine is enabled with this thing called BitLocker. It's basically a security feature on the Windows systems that encrypts the drive for your security. Basically, it's like encrypts the drive. So maybe that's what he's talking about. Usually, when we have this, we have to decrypt the drive, turn off BitLocker. It takes a while. It just decrypts the drive, and once you do that, you usually have no problem doing things with the drive, like partition or cloning or whatever, that kind of thing. I don't know. It's something to think about. KB2HHU, back to net.
Okay, very good. That's a good point. I've never used BitLocker. I have other encryption software that I prefer. It always seems to me that Microsoft, if they can do a job mediocre, they do it mediocre. So I try not to rely on their specific solutions. Frank, are you aware of BitLocker? Do you use it?
I'm not sophisticated enough to know about that stuff. It's kind of too late to try any of these fixes anyway. The tech already swapped out the drives, I think. I suspect something I'm using, like I run Speechify, is this kind of, and I suspect they may have some logging on there that's clogging up the drive. So I kind of assume that just about everything is out in the clouds these days, but something like that is possible. And one of the things I'll ask the tech when he delivers the equipment back to me tomorrow is what he suggests I do to keep the thing from just clogging up again. Because this is kind of a nuisance. I have some projects that have to be finished, and this is putting me behind. Fortunately, nothing critical that absolutely has to be done this week, but I still have to get some stuff done. Anyway, so, yeah, just thought I'd ask that, and, I heard before that Dell does some strange things that cause problems. And I was going to call Dell tomorrow morning and have them fix it, and then I found out that the local fella would take the machines, do a drive transplant, and have everything fixed at like half the cost, and ran into this glitch, which is hopefully minor. Anyway, back to net. Going to go do some other things here. WB2BXO.
A quick question for Frank.
Yeah, Paul, sure.
Good. Yeah, Frank, did you say that you operate remotes?